Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 10, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleforum conference call, as today we discuss Williams v. Pennsylvania, Supreme Court case decided yesterday. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back return guests to Practice Group podcast, John J. Park Jr., known as Jack Park. He's of counsel at Strickland Brockington Lewis in Atlanta, Georgia. He's going to give us some background on the case and then tell us all about the decision and its implications. With that, Jack Park, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean, and thank you for this opportunity to discuss an important case on recusal standards. Yesterday, in Williams versus Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court held that the participation of a former district attorney for Philadelphia, who had approved the prosecution of Williams for the death penalty, in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's denial of Williams' fifth request for post-conviction relief represented a structural constitutional error. After being the DA in Philadelphia, the justice ran for and was elected or was appointed to, I'm not sure which, to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Pennsylvania does have judicial elections. And it looks like he was elected directly from his DA spot. The court vacated the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's denial of relief and remanded the case for further proceedings. As the court put the rule, when a judge has had an earlier significant personal involvement as a prosecutor in a critical decision in the defendant's case, the risk of actual bias rises to an unconstitutional level. In such a case, the judge is required to recuse. Let's start with a nugget from Justice Thomas's dissent. He points to Marbury versus Madison, in which then Secretary of State John Marshall sealed but failed to deliver William Marbury's commission, and then, as newly appointed Chief Justice, Marshall decided whether mandamus was an appropriate remedy to require James Madison to finish the job. Nobody thought Marshall should recuse after that participation, and one wonders what the result would be today. The underlying case, Williams and Draper purported to give somebody named Norwood a ride home. Instead, they drove him to a cemetery where they beat him to death with a tire iron and a socket wrench. Williams later returned to the cemetery, soaked the body in gasoline, and set it on fire. Draper, who testified for the state, said that the motive was robbery, making the crime a felony murder eligible for the death penalty. In addition, Williams had what I think Justice Thomas calls a significant history of violent felony convictions that included a murder committed when he was 17. The assistant DA submitted a memorandum that went through her chief and then the DA, Ronald Castile, for permission to seek the death penalty, and Castile approved it. At trial, Williams testified that he was not involved and did not know Norwood. The jury did not believe him. Williams was convicted and sentenced to death, and on direct review, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court affirmed the conviction and the sentence. In Williams' first state habeas petition, he claimed that his trial counsel was ineffective in failing to present evidence of Williams' childhood sexual abuse. In his dissent, Chief Justice Roberts notes that Williams testified, contrary to his trial testimony, that he knew Norwood and that Norwood had molested him. The Pennsylvania courts denied relief on that petition, and two later state habeas petitions were denied as untimely. And a federal habeas petition was denied. The fifth petition, which is the basis for this case, is based on a claimed Brady violation and Draper's statements to Williams' counsel. Draper's says that he told the assistant DA that Norwood had abused Williams and that the abuse was the reason for the murder. He says the assistant DA told him to give false testimony about the motive being robbery. Draper also says that the assistant DA said she'd write a letter to the parole board for him. At trial, his testimony was that his deal was to plead guilty in exchange for a truthful testimony with no other inducements. The Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas granted relief after a hearing, finding a Brady violation and directing resentencing. The state appealed. In the Court of Common Pleas, a memorandum in which a prosecution for a capital crime was approved was produced. Williams, noting that now Chief Justice Castile had approved the memo when he was DA, filed a motion seeking Castile's recusal. Castile denied the motion without referring it to the court. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court reversed, reinstating Williams' death sentence in an opinion by Justice Eakin, which Castile joined. He also wrote a concurrence in which he criticized the Court of Common Pleas and the Federal Public Defender's Office, which he saw as having an obstructionist anti-death penalty agenda. In sum, 30 years after he approved the plan to prosecute Williams for a capital offense, the Chief Justice participated in denying Williams' fifth post-conviction claim for relief. The court, in an opinion by Justice Kennedy, held that Chief Justice Castile's participation constituted a structural constitutional error. As the majority acknowledged, the court's due process precedents do not set forth a specific test governing recusal when, as here, a judge has prior involvement in a case as a prosecutor. It held, though, under the due process clause, there is an impermissible risk of actual bias when a judge earlier had a significant personal involvement as a prosecutor in a critical decision regarding the defendant's case. The court reasoned that instead of looking for actual bias, it asks whether, as an objective matter, the average judge in his position is likely to be neutral, or whether there is an unconstitutional potential for bias. That potential for bias standard comes from the Caperton decision several terms ago. The court pointed to In re Murchison from 1955, in which a judge in Michigan observed witnesses testify as a one-man grand jury and then subsequently served as judge when he and was convicted both two men whom he saw testify when he was convinced that one was lying and another obstructing justice. The Murchison court held that the judge's position as accuser and decision maker in the contempt proceedings violated due process. Acknowledging that Murchison's facts, quote, differ in many respects from a case like this one, the court nonetheless said that Murchison's constitutional principles are fully applicable where a judge has a direct personal role in the defendant's prosecution. Those principles reach broadly. The involvement of multiple actors and the passage of time do not relieve the former prosecutor of the duty to withdraw in order to ensure the neutrality of the judicial process in determining the consequences that his or her own earlier critical decision may have set in motion. Applying that reasoning, the court finds that Castile's involvement at the trial stage was direct and personal. It was also critical. Without his concurrence, the death penalty was not in play. The court also pointed to Castile's judicial election campaign, in which he pointed to the 45 death sentences imposed during his tenure as DA. As an editorial note, I sort of wonder whether those on the court who don't like judicial elections see this as a cautionary tale. The court pointed to the Court of Common Pleas findings of Brady violations and what it saw as a conflict of interest that they created, and to the utility of statutes and professional codes of conduct that provide more protection than due process requires. Again, provide more protection than due process requires comes from Caperton. The ABA Code of Judicial Conduct, for example, provides that a judge may not sit in any proceeding in which the judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned, including where the judge served in government employment and in such capacity participated personally and substantially as a lawyer or public official concerning the proceeding. Finally, the court deemed Castile's failure to recuse a structural error, even though his vote on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was not critical to the outcome. It found support in concurring statements and concurring opinions by Justices Brennan and Blackmun in the 1986 decision Aetna versus Lavoie. The court intoned, a multi-member court must not have its neutrality undermined, for the appearance of bias demeans the reputation and integrity not just of one jurist, but of the entire institution of which he or she is a part. So it sent the case back to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, where Castile, now retired, will not participate. Justice Kennedy wrote for the court and was joined by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justice Alito, dissented, and Justice Thomas wrote a separate dissent. Note that last term, Justice Breyer, and joined by Justice Ginsburg, wrote a dissenting opinion in Glossop, a death penalty case in which they argued that the death penalty is unconstitutional. One might expect them to find ways to vote in ways that would upset a death penalty, even where its constitutionality, either generally or procedurally, is not before them. Years ago, in California, voters ousted Rose Byrd and two other justices of the California Supreme Court. Rose Byrd never voted for the state in a death penalty case, and there's a book by Preble Stoltz about it. In his dissent, Chief Justice Roberts criticized the court for relying on a proverb instead of precedent. No man can be a judge in his own case. Justice Thomas points to the presence of that proverb in Lord Cook's Institutes. Chief Justice Roberts points to the untimeliness of Williams' state habeas petition and his inability to overcome the time bar. Chief Justice Roberts argued that Murchison does not support the majority's new rule, far from it. In his dissent, Justice Thomas complained, rather than constitutionalize every judicial qualification rule, the court has left such rules to bar associations, legislatures, and the judgment of individual adjudicators. Williams, moreover, is not a criminal defendant. His complaint is instead that the due process protections in his state post-conviction proceedings, an altogether new civil matter, not a continuation of his criminal trial, were lacking. He observes that Williams' sentence has been final for 25 years. Finally, Justice Thomas points to the expansion of Caperton's standard of probability of actual bias to state post-conviction remedies proceedings, which are, as he notes, fundamentally different from criminal trials. The result seems to be the federalization and the constitutionalization of ABA and similar recusal standards. The court, as it has done elsewhere, observes that some 28 states have adopted those standards or, quote, language similar, close quote, to them. Now all of the states have them. And I guess between Caperton and Williams, the standard will be probability of actual bias. With that, Dean, I think I'm open for questions.
Thank you very much. Before we turn to the audience for questions, let me just remind the audience to check the Federal Society's website. And of course, check in with your emails early next week to figure out our schedule for next week's schedule of telephone conference calls. It is another decision week in the Supreme Court, so there'll undoubtedly be some cases and decisions emerging that we'll cover. Today, of course, we're talking to Jack Park about the Williams versus Pennsylvania case. We're going to open the floor to questions. If you have a question, in a moment we'll hear this announcement that will say to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So please stand by. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Jack Park, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time left for questions. Let me get the ball rolling here, if I could, and ask whether or not you think the result would be the same here or different if this were anything but a death penalty case, anything but a capital case, if it were another crime of violence or even a nonviolent crime, but otherwise the facts were identical. Do we get the same result from this Supreme Court?
It's hard to tell, but I sort of think the answer to the question is yes, in the sense that the court might have denied cert, or it might have been persuaded by the problems with the vehicle, which is the fact that this is an untimely petition, or appears to be, and in order to prevail, Williams would have to overcome the untimeliness by satisfying the standards under Pennsylvania law. So it's very much bound up in, it would also be bound up in a state rule of decision.
Right. You mentioned Caperton, which is just, but by the way, again, if you're in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button. If you have a question, our lines are wide open. You mentioned in your opening remarks the Caperton decision, which is not that long ago, just a couple years old or a few years old. Is it uncommon for the court to enter into this realm as often as it has been? That is the realm of judicial recusals. Any reason for that?
I think Caperton was something. I don't think there's much of a predecessor for Caperton in recent years. I'm trying to think back, but you know, Murchison's an older case, and there's the case Toomey about the judge who benefited from the imposition of fines institutionally, and that's an older case. Aetna versus Lavoie is older. So while the court has touched on judicial recusals from time to time, I think Caperton represents a change, and it's something of a response to judicial elections, because there the issue was, what was the effect of contributions on the appellate judge on the West Virginia Supreme Court? And clearly the court builds on Caperton for this decision.
Very good. We do have a question from our audience. We'll turn to momentarily. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take our first call of the day.
Yeah, I want to piggyback off his question. So do you think that due to the fact that the liberal wing of the Supreme Court doesn't like the death penalty, that did have something to do with it?
I think it may well have something to do with it. They, if you look at the statistics, they seem to align pretty consistently and more consistently than the people seen as the conservative wing. That said, they are also sometimes seem not to be fans of either judicial elections, and there are some death penalty opponents in there. So all of those factors may have weighed into the decision to grant certiorari, and then played into the result.
I understand the once again, sorry, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines, again, are wide open. While we're waiting, let me ask another question of you, Jack Park. What's next in this case? I understand the justice involved has retired. The Supreme Court, that is, has reached a decision. What happens now?
It goes back to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for, you know, the standard further proceedings consistent. Well, you know, Castile's gone, so the court that's there now can decide what to do with the Court of Common Pleas setting aside William's death sentence, they can, I suppose, affirm that decision of the Court of Common Pleas, in which case Williams would be resentenced, or alternatively, they could deny the petition as untimely and apply Pennsylvania law to that effect.
Very good. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, so let's check in with another caller now.
Hi, this is Bill Hodes calling. I was traveling when the case came down, and but I thought I would weigh in anyway.
Hey, Bill.
I was struck by a couple of things about the. I read the case quickly while I was on the plane. A couple of things. I mean, one is why in the world the justice. Since they had more than a majority without his vote, why was he so stupid as to not just step down? And I think a related point is he not only retired, he retired like 2 weeks after this decision. So it seems as if he was certainly vindicating the sense that he was, he wanted to see this through. Damn it, he's going to decide it, get this guy on death row, and then retire with the job well done. I think that might have affected the court's look at the case as well. Do you think that might be right?
The court might have perceived that. The petition for recusal came, as it typically does, to the individual justice who denies it, and the alternative would be to refer it to the court, but we typically look to the individual jurist in the first instance, and he could have said, again, this is 30 years old, and if he follows Justice Thomas's view, it's an entirely different case. It's a stretch to shoehorn it into the original case through Brady. So both of those could have been in play. Just going larger, from my own experience, I know that Judge Carnes did death penalty work when he was in the Alabama Supreme Court, and Judge Pryor on Bill Pryor on the 11th Circuit was the Attorney General. So any brief that went under his signature, and they are both federal judges where the standard appears to be more rigorous and also more careful. I don't think they participate in any of the cases that were in the office at the time.
No, absolutely. I would think not. My second comment is about the, as was raised before, the Supreme U.S. Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this and its relationship to Caperton. I mean, my view of the difference between these cases is actually leaving aside whether it's a constitutional violation, what the judge was alleged to have done or actually allowed to be done, which is somebody else contributed to his pact, not to him, was absolutely not improper. There was absolutely no reason why he should have recused, whereas this justice seems to me in Pennsylvania, I think on the merits it was absolutely outrageous that he didn't follow the precedents you just met and stepped out, whether it was 30 years ago, it was clearly... He was the guy who put this guy on death row, and this proceeding is to get him off death row. He should absolutely never have sat in this case, and I think he should be punished. If he didn't retire, he should have been punished for it by the state authorities for a violation of judicial ethics. But when it gets to the Supreme, when it gets to the federal level and you constitutionalize it, I think there is you have to be more exacting, it seems to me, about how far you go in order to bring in the federal habeas corpus and the whole due process clause. And I guess my bottom line is it wouldn't bother me so much if Williams was the only case and they had indeed said if you go this far, like Tumio versus Ohio, where you have a stake in it. This judge had a stake in making sure this guy stayed on death row, it wouldn't particularly bother me very much, but it bothers me a lot that it's seen as an easy extension and solidification of Caperton, which was a travesty. That's a long comment, but that's my view.
Yeah, one response, Bill, on page 14 of the opinion, which is in the majority, the court notes that when Williams filed his recusal motion, Pennsylvania's Code of Judicial Conduct would disqualify a judge from a proceeding in which the judge served as a lawyer in the matter in controversy, or a lawyer with whom they previously practiced served through such association as a lawyer concerning the matter. You know, I suppose Castile could have looked at that and said, I didn't serve as a lawyer in the matter. But,
sure he did.
You know, he may have been.
He was a senior partner of the prosecutor who sought the death penalty. He approved it personally.
Correct.
Anyway, he did approve it. Yeah. In any event. Oh, just one more comment about what's going to happen next. I assume since the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in the case, in the underlying opinion, found that there was an exception to the timeliness rule, but nonetheless, but rejected the Brady claim on the merits. If it's sent back to them, isn't there still enough of a majority just to uphold the death penalty, to reverse the lower Pennsylvania court instead of what, 5-2, it would now be 4-2 or something like that? I don't know, but I imagine.
If the court were as it was when they acted, the answer would be yes. There may have been changes in the personnel
That's
of that
true.
Court. And again, it was the lower court that found the Brady violations and directed the resentencing. So it was the Supreme Court with Castile's concurrence and concurring opinion that overturned that, and
I think they may still overturn it.
They may still overturn it, and in which case Williams keeps what he's got.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question. Maybe this is Dean Wang, and maybe ask a question of either or both of you, since we have Bill Hodes on the line. Yesterday there was also I don't know if it's breaking news, but news of a man in Virginia, I think it was. Found guilty originally of the murder of four people. He confessed at the age of 14, served for 8 years, even though a hired killer, a professional killer, confessed to the crimes. I think yesterday or even in the recent past, at least, he was released when the prosecutors themselves said they no longer stood behind the case. Do either of you change your mind here, or Bill, do you change your mind in particular if imagine a different set of facts here where a justice deciding a case was involved in a prosecution that had reversed its thinking on the case, and the Supreme Court of a state ultimately let somebody go? Does the conflict run in both directions there, if you follow my inartfully worded question?
Bill, any thoughts?
Well, I think probably the answer would be that the bar against participating when you've had a role is a bar in participating and seeking to uphold the same result. If the people who are now litigating the case on behalf of the state have a different view,
well,
it could be said no, that he would have a interest in vindicating the view at the time that he was in the hot seat. And so, yeah, it probably should apply in both directions. That's my gut instinct.
Yeah, I guess the hypothetical would be that these prosecutors refuse to stand behind the decision, and somehow it gets to the state Supreme Court, in which case one of these prosecutors is then on the court. That even though it ran in one direction, one would think that the judge has taken a position with respect and acted in a personal, substantial way with respect to a critical issue in the case, and that could meet
right.
the standard that's set out here.
Yep, I think that's right.
We do have another question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll say goodbye to Bill Holtz for now, unless he rings back in, and move on to our next caller.
Hello, this is Bob Davis in Maine. Are there rules governing the recusal of Supreme Court justices? If so, what are they, or is it totally an individual decision on the part of the justice? If there are not, can Congress impose those kinds of rules and seek enforcement only through impeachment and removal?
My recollection is that it's probably the justices. Now, we'd note that Justice Kagan recused from cases that were in the solicitor's office or in the Department of Justice and the solicitor was consulted when she was there. So for a while after she came on the court, she wasn't hearing cases in which the United States was involved. You can see recusals in some cases where it looks like there's an economic interest of the judge involved. And I know the courts of appeals are getting more insistent about disclosure of corporate affiliations, which is a disqualifying factor. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, what happens if the justice does not recuse and there is a good case to be made that he or she ought to?
I think you would leave it to the individual justice, and then I suppose your remedy would then be impeachment if somebody was really upset with it.
And is there a standard in existence that the Supreme Court has come up with, or is there a statutory standard for when one should recuse?
That I'm not sure, but we do see justices acting in cases where, you know, one would think that recusal was appropriate.
Okay, thank you.
You know, in contrast, in the Ninth Circuit, we saw Judge Reinhardt participating in a case brought by a foundation that his wife worked on, and apparently he saw no conflict.
All right, thank you very much.
We do have one more question pending. Again, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone.
Hi, it's Bill Hodes again. Then I have to read off and get back to where I just wanted to comment on that last question. There is no code of conduct or no rule that's applicable to the Supreme Court. There is a code of conduct that's applicable to other federal judges, such as Judge Reinhardt, and others. The question of whether and the justices on the Supreme Court do treat it seriously, and they write opinions, chamber's opinions, usually about whether they will or will not recuse. They will explain sometimes they will not. They routinely, as in Justice Kagan's case, they, you know, if they were in the SG's office, they will almost they always step down in those cases. The question that was asked before, whether Congress could write a statute and codify, you know, the judicial code for other, that's applicable to other federal judges and make it apply to the Supreme Court as well. I think that's a very tough question. There's a possibility that it would be unconstitutional as violating separation of powers, but it's also possible that it would be constitutional because the necessary and proper clause, if you read it carefully, it says it's, you know, that's necessary and proper to carry out all of the various powers that the Congress has. And one of the powers that the Congress has is setting up the judicial system, of course, other than the Supreme Court. So it's kind of a catch-22 as to how that would work. My guess is that Congress wouldn't try it because they would be too fearful that it would have too many separation of powers issues. But if a bad enough case came along, there would be sufficient rumblings about an impeachment. But that's just very, very, that's way, way out there. We're accustomed to Supreme Courts making decisions that we don't like, and we usually use the public political forum, use free speech rather than impeachment. But that's my take on it in any event.
I think that's right. You know, the court, by recusing, by justices recusing, takes care of its own business.
Generally,
and, you know,
speaking,
in your earlier question,
what if
could Castile have taken care of his own business? Yeah, he could. He might have protected this, bulletproofed this thing, but he chose not to for reasons he didn't disclose. And then in the deep past, this is right after Justice Rehnquist got on the court, he declined to recuse and wrote an opinion about it. I forget the name of the case. But
right.
it involved an issue that, yeah.
It was a voting rights case issue. And Justice Scalia also wrote a refusal to recuse, wrote a very sharp and quite witty in the, where he was alleged to be, he was in the same hunting camp with Vice President Cheney. It was the issue of one of these independent commissions that the vice president was part of, or it was challenging one of the administration's positions, I forget what, and Scalia quite properly said, "What the hell are you talking about? You know, just because I was at a hunting camp." And it didn't involve any personal, you know, it's not as if Cheney or my personal finances were involved. But that was a very significant opinion, actually, of Scalia's. And I'm sure when people start doing collected works of Nino Scalia's best opinions, that will probably be in there.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question, the time is now to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We do have another question, so hold on here a second.
Yeah, this is Stephen Vaden in Washington, D.C., and I had a question about the court's attitude toward judicial elections. You mentioned that in this opinion, as well as, of course, the earlier Caperton case, the justices seem to, at least some of them, in the majority, seem to have been hostile to the notion or particularly worried about the notion of states choosing to elect their judges through popular elections. And yet another case in the news out in California, we see an effort to recall a judge who issued what many people believe to be a very light sentence in a serious sexual assault case. And the people who seem to be leading that charge are, generally speaking, on the more liberal side of the political spectrum and might be people who otherwise would be in favor of what they call merit appointment rather than judicial election for state selection of judges. And so I'm wondering if you think that what we're seeing out in California may give some of those on the federal courts and in particular the Supreme Court a new perspective about judicial elections. Or do you think that people's opinions are kind of hardened one way or the other, and the fact that in this particular instance in California, members of the political left seem to be more in favor of using the judicial election option to remove whom they see as a bad judge who made an egregious decision won't have any effect on how they view the issue?
The court kind of grudgingly accepts judicial elections, it seems to me, or members of the court grudgingly accept it. They think there's better ways to do it. I'm for my part, I'm not convinced. In writing, I've pointed to the case for accountability, which you get. And in California, if that judge is elected, then you can take your dissatisfaction with that ruling to the ballot box and use it as a referendum. With a federal judge, you can't do that because that judge is appointed for life. In an merit system, you may not be able to do that directly, in the sense that elections are often retention elections, which are the judge against nobody, and it takes a lot to take out a judge when there's no alternative. One of the merits of judicial elections, if they're contested, is that they're contested, and they can present competing views of the judicial role. So I think in the grand scheme of things, I don't think it's going to change anything from the court, and I think that what's going on is just the notion of judges, we like their independence and we also like their accountability, and both considerations are in play.
One more call for questions. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. Seeing none, let me give you a chance to express any final thoughts if you have any, Jack Park.
Well, just to repeat, I think the result of this case in Caperton is a federalization and constitutionalization of recusal standards that look at the probability of actual bias. And to the extent that not all of the states have the same standards, now all of the states may have them in both civil and criminal cases, calling Williams a petition a criminal case. So with that, Dean, thank you very much. Unless there's anything else, I'm done.
I think we are done. Thank you, Jack Park. And on behalf of the Federal Society and on behalf of our callers, I also want to thank our callers for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. Reminder to check your emails and our website for the schedule for next week, which will be fluid given the Supreme Court's expected decisions. But until our next teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.